Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the Transportation and Transit Policy and Oversight Division meeting for today, February 11th, 2009. We have three items on the agenda today, and we're going to take them in the order that they are on the agenda. The first item will be Representative Portman's House File 267. I'll plan to give that a maximum of 45 minutes. Hopefully we can get done a little sooner than that, but I want to give this very important issue the amount of time needed to hear the testimony and have debate. Then we're going to have a short, maybe 5 minute or so concluding presentation from Mike Schottauer from the Office of Transit at MnDOT. He'll be completing his overview from last week. And we'll take any outstanding questions or comments from members about Greater Minnesota Transit at that time. And then our final agenda item will be the statewide rail plan conversation. So, again, as always, we have a lot to do in a short amount of time, so keep that in mind. And with that, Representative Portman, you want to move your bill as a member of the committee?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would move House File 267 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Public Safety Policy Committee.
Thank you very much, and you can proceed with your testimony, Representative Portman. Welcome.
Thank you, Chairman Hornstein and members of the committee. I will be very brief because I will let the testifier tell you the story about the bill and really the details about the bill, but it's a very simple provision. In Minnesota law right now, you have to put a child in a baby seat when they're a baby, and then you have to put the child into a proper child restraint seat, oftentimes it's a booster seat, up until they're 4. And we have become in a minority of states that only protect children up to the age of 4. Most states protect children longer than that. And we know medically, we know from our craft statistics, that it's important to properly restrain children between the ages of 4 and 8. So what this bill would do is it would change the law to protect children all the way up to the age of 8 to be in a properly designed restraint system that respects their physiology and what happens to their body in the event of a traffic accident. As a practical matter, I want to tell you, in the state of North Carolina, they protect up until age 8. I was in North Carolina over Christmas. My in-laws are from there. My nephew was 7 years old and 11/12, he told me. And he had his booster seat in the garage, staying at Grandpa's house, 3 hours from his house, and it was a very simple issue of whoever Ethan was riding with. We put the booster seat in that particular car. These are easy things to deal with. It's not complicated. And because that was the law in North Carolina, Ethan knew that if he was going to get in Grandpa's car, he was going to bring the booster seat. If he was going to get in the car that my husband and I were driving, he was going to bring the booster seat. And why was that? Because he was 7 years old and 11/12. If you asked him how old he was, he would tell you he was 7 years old and 11/12. And so when we have a law, it presents a very clear guideline for the public, for kids, for parents. It's easy to understand so that they can do the right thing. With that, I'd like to introduce Gail Weinholzer from AAA to discuss the bill.
Thank you, Representative Portman. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Weinholzer.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Gail Weinholzer. I'm the Director of Public Affairs for AAA Minnesota, Iowa, and I'm here representing our 700,000 members across the state of Minnesota. Before I begin, I want to share with you the materials that were provided in your packets. The first is a flyer that was produced by Safe Kids that has a lot of the key statistics around this issue, both at the state and the national level. The second is a guest editorial that was written by Safe Kids and AAA regarding a crash that occurred in the state of Minnesota just this past August. It really highlights the issues that we have with this legislation quite well. The next handout is a map of the United States. As you may recall, when I came before your committee 2 years ago, we were one of 12 states that did not adequately restrain children after the age of 4. Now we are one of 6. On the back of the information is also some statistics from North Memorial that shows you quite clearly how effective a booster seat has shown itself to be in the state of Minnesota. I know there are a lot of national statistics, but I want to provide you with one hospital's example within our own state boundaries. And then the last is a guest editorial, or an op-ed piece that was written by the Star Tribune in support of this legislation. As I said, AAA is leading a broad-based coalition of organizations in support of House File 267. Some of those organizations are here today to testify. While others will speak about health care issues and law enforcement issues, I'm here, as I said, to speak on behalf of our 700,000 members who overwhelmingly support this legislation. Annually, when we do our survey, the results come back at 78% wanting an enhanced child restraint law in the state of Minnesota. Child passenger safety is a top priority for AAA this session, which has, as I mentioned, one of the weakest laws in the nation. In fact, 44 other states do a better job protecting our nation's youngest passengers than we do. Our current child restraint law was developed more than 26 years ago. I jokingly remind my staff that some of them are actually younger than this legislation, and that I just say that to point out the fact that this legislation is out of date and does a very inadequate job protecting our children. Our nation's transportation systems and the vehicles that travel them were not originally designed with children in mind. Seat belts were designed to restrain adults, thus putting children at a greater risk of injury and death. Given that we're now a more mobile society and children are traveling more than ever, whether it's gymnastics, t-ball, church activities, all that sort of thing, it's an enormous challenge for us to adapt our roadways and our vehicles to accommodate the increasing number of children traveling, increasing number of miles. I'd like to invite Shannon Swanson and Abby Swanson forward. They are constituents of Representative Holbert. And Abby actually testified in, or was part of this demonstration 2 years ago when she was 4 years old. Now she's six. In fact, she'll probably tell you she turned six yesterday. That was a big deal. She got an iPod and the world is a happier place. Abby just turned six, as I said. According to Minnesota State statute, right now she'd be adequately restrained in an adult seatbelt. And Shannon will demonstrate, as Abby puts on her seatbelt, the problem with that. And the problem with that is that Abby's knees are bending before the edge of the seat. So typically what happens with children, because they're so uncomfortable, they slouch down a little bit so that their knees are bending where the seat bends. And that's typical for children because that's the way they're going to try and be more comfortable. Well, what happens then is that the last portion of the seatbelt goes off of their hips and up onto their stomach. And that can cause serious intestinal injuries in the event of a crash. The other problem is that you'll notice the upper portion of the seatbelt will either rub against her face or her neck. And what children typically do, because again, that's very uncomfortable for them, they typically put it behind their back. Well, what happens in the event of a crash is Abby's body will, the top portion will launch itself forward, and she unfortunately will most likely sustain a spinal cord injury. And those are the sorts of injuries that a nurse from HCMC will discuss with you as the next testifier. So that's what we're trying to avoid, is that ill-fitting adult restraint device. So what Shannon will do now is grab a backless booster. These are very inexpensive, $13 or $14 a Target at best. And what it does is it allows the adult seatbelt to properly restrain a child of this age. Abby will put it back across her, and you'll notice now her knees are bending at the end of the booster seat, which makes her more comfortable, so she's not going to slouch down. That bottom portion of the lap belt is not going to slide up onto her stomach, and the top portion is going to fit across her shoulder, as it should, because we want seat belts across the shoulders and the hips, because that's where the bony areas are that can absorb a crash much better than the soft tissue in the stomach and the neck. So thank you, Abby. You've done a very nice job. Moving along, as I said, our current law says under age 4, a child must be an appropriate restraint device, and that's typically the car seat. And might I add, the car seat is actually the expensive portion of the purchase. The current law mandates a car seat, and that's typically $50 to $75, depending on how fancy a product you buy. Again, the booster seat, backless booster, is a $12 purchase at Target. But current legislation gives parents the false impression that after age 3, children are perfectly safe in the adult seatbelt. And that's nothing could be further from the truth. The Children's Hospital of Philadelphia has done extensive research on this issue and has found that properly fitted booster seats for this age group reduces the chances of serious injury by 59% and of fatalities by over 28%. As AAA and others provide child passenger safety clinics around the state, the first question parents always ask us is, what does the law say? And that is so frustrating from our point of view, because the law is 26 years old, out of date, and does not provide adequate information. So we tell people the law says you have to have your child in a restraint device through age 3, and then after that it's no longer necessary. But we always tell them best practice is. And then we tell them about child restraint devices through age 7 or up to age 8. Unfortunately, we've had some frustration in that area. Despite all the education we've done, we've been working on this issue more than 10 years to make parents aware of the importance of the restraint device and the protection it provides to children. The most recent survey done by the Department of Public Safety here in the state of Minnesota showed that over 90% of parents were aware of the importance of keeping their child in a proper restraint device through age 7. Yet less than 50% were actually doing it. And that's the concern that we have. So beyond the educational component, we need your help. We need an appropriate child restraint law that's more modern than the current piece that's 26 years old and that does a better job protecting our youngest passengers. Before I close, I want to clear up just a few misunderstandings. This law is not intended for the purpose of ticketing parents and caregivers. And if you'll notice in the statute, it clearly says that the fine may be waived within 14 days if a caregiver or parent produces proof of having purchased or acquired an adequate child restraint device. But I talked to law enforcement, they said this is no different than, you know, if they're cited for having perhaps a burnt out light bulb. They come in, they show that they've purchased one, had it installed, and the citation is torn up and it goes away. Secondly, it's not a fundraiser for the state of Minnesota. The state raised in total approximately $25,000 last year across the entire state of Minnesota. So it's not a revenue generator for the state. And that those funds that were raised actually goes into a special account at the Department of Public Safety. And they use that money for needy families that might need to purchase a car seat or a booster seat. So it goes to good use. I urge you on behalf of our membership to vote in favor of this legislation. Again, all we are asking is that you modernize and update a current state statute. We're not asking you to create new law. I thank you for your time. And now I'd like to introduce you to Julie Philbrook, a nurse from HCMC who's going to represent the Duncan family today. She'll be followed by Dr. Kragu from HCMC and Officer Rustin from the Apple Valley Police Department. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Weinholzer.
We do have a few slides that we'd like to include
okay.
in our presentation.
So, Ms. Philbrook, if you could just state your name and affiliation for our record, that would be great.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Julie Philbrook, and I'm a nurse at Hennepin County Medical Center. And for the past 17 years, I've coordinated our trauma prevention programs in the community. I've spoken to these committees several times in the past about Minnesota's child passenger safety law. I've talked about the facts and statistics, but today I'm here to tell you something very different. I'm here to be the voice of a little girl named Brynn Duncan. She would be here today, but she has already missed too much school this year, and her injury and her trip from Moorhead is a tough one these days. I brought you some photos of Brynn so that you can get to know her better. My hope and Brynn's family's prayer is that this that you will hear her story and vow that not one more child in Minnesota will have to endure what she went through this fall and what she will live with for the rest of her life. Fran is a spunky and tenacious 7-year-old who, according to her mother Dixie, she would never walk, but she ran, she skipped, she jumped wherever she went. Like most kids her age, she loved sports and playing with friends. However, on August 18th of this year, Bryn's life changed in an instant. On a last-minute shopping trip with her grandmother, Bryn was not using the booster seat she usually rode in while with her family. She was restrained with only a seatbelt, and since the law only required, that is what the law requires. Because the adult seatbelt did not fit properly, like you saw with Abby, the lap portion rode up over her hips and onto her stomach. Bryn had placed the shoulder portion of the adult seatbelt behind her back, as children of this age and size often do, to prevent it from resting on her face. The vehicle she was riding in was involved in a crash in Fergus Falls area. According to the paramedics first on the scene, Bryn was found unconscious with her head between her knees. The impact caused Bryn's upper body to fly forward violently, and because of this, she suffered these severe injuries, which Dr. Tarago will share with you more in depth after I'm done. But because the shoulder portion of the seatbelt was not in place, her spinal cord was permanently severed at the waist. Because that lap portion of the seatbelt was not low on her hips, her internal organs were catastrophically damaged. Bryn suffered immense pain, depression, severe fevers, and infections. Weeks went by as her survival did lay in the balance. She spent close to 2 months at Hennepin County Medical Center, the majority of that time in our intensive care unit. Her intestines were in such shock that she was not able to tolerate food for weeks. And when she did try to eat, the pain was often unbearable. After a great time of great depression and tears, the spark did come back to her eyes. She was able to sit up, learn to dress herself, and transfer to a wheelchair. Bryn came back, but her ability to feel and move her legs did not. She will be paralyzed for the rest of her life. Her grandmother, Linda Duncan, shared last week at the Senate hearing how badly she feels for the injuries Bryn suffered. Linda was driving the car. She told the committee that no one can imagine how badly she feels as she watches Bryn each day. She was following our current law. She did not know that she should have used a booster seat for Bryn. She said she wants others to learn from her mistake. Bryn spent another month in rehabilitation and is now back home in Moorhead and back at school. However, she still requires round-the-clock care to be sure that her bowel and bladder functions correctly. Her mother gets up twice a night to attend to these needs. The family could not stay in their current home as it was too small for Bryn to even wheel into the bathroom. The whole town of Moorhead has rallied for Bryn with fundraisers, and due to the kindness of others, they are having a new house built. A recent AAA study found that a majority of parents rely on the state's legislation to guide them on how they restrain their children in the vehicle. When we asked Bryn's mom to help us promote this law requiring booster seats, Dixie said, "We want to do more to help other families to prevent this." Because Dixie had previously recognized the lack of support the normal seatbelt provided Bryn, she made sure she regularly used the booster seat. However, on the day of the crash, a quick shift in plans resulted in the transfer of Bryn into her grandmother's car, where the booster seat was not present. Had it been a state law, Dixie said Bryn would never have gone without it. If it had been the law, we would have automatically had the booster seat with us. Bryn and her family have agreed to have her story told so that not one more child will suffer through the injuries she's experienced. She is once again a spunky and tenacious child who loves school and sports. She has just had to find a new way to participate. But there are hard days too, like the days she had to leave her old home and said, "It's because of me we have to move." You see, like I said before, they were not able to stay in their home. And fortunately, people have rallied together to help build them a new home. And it's under construction as we speak. Or there are days when she cries as she watches her friends run and jump in gym class. On the day she got her new wheelchair, Dixie was so excited for her, but she cried as she never thought she would get so excited for her daughter to get a new wheelchair. But I also know that together with her family's faith and love and support from the community, Bryn will thrive. I have heard the arguments against this law. Some parents don't like laws to tell them how to transport their children. Others think having a booster seat until the child is 8 would be a hassle. They cannot imagine having to get their child to use one or spending $50 for each child that needs one. Bryn's family says booster kits for Bryn, it is a hassle, but for the safety they provide, outweighs any money spent. 2 years ago, I brought my 4-year-old daughter here to demonstrate how booster seat works. She asked me, "What do they do in this place?" I told her, as how you can explain to a 4-year-old, I said, "They make rules to help people safe." Please pass this law to keep the children of Minnesota safe. Pass this law for Bryn. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next we have Dr. Karagu, Hennepin County Medical Center. So you also could state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the House Transportation and Transit Policy Committee. My name is Andrew Kiragu. I'm the medical director of the Pediatric Intensive Care Unit at Hennepin County Medical Center. I also serve on the board of the Minnesota chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. And I thank you for this opportunity to testify before you about the importance of the legislation regarding booster seat use for children ages 4 to 8. In addition to my duties as an ICU physician at Hennepin, I serve as a principal investigator for the Injury Free Coalition for Kids of Minneapolis, which is part of a national organization founded to research injury prevention methods. In fact, members of our organization, such as Flora Winston at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, have done a lot of the study looking at booster seat use. As a pediatric intensive care physician, I have the daily privilege of taking care of children that are critically ill or seriously injured. Unfortunately, given the nature of the work that I do, I see a fair amount of suffering experienced by the most vulnerable of those amongst us, our children. Death and devastating life-changing disability are some of the saddest things that I see. I'm personally, however, most saddened when the injuries could have easily been prevented. I want to acknowledge and thank Bryn Duncan and her family for allowing us to share her story. I was one of Bryn's physicians for nearly 2 months when she was at HCMC from mid-August till October last year. She sustained injuries in a motor vehicle crash, which has changed her life and her family's lives forever. She was not riding in a booster seat, although she was wearing a seatbelt, and as Julie has mentioned, had placed the shoulder portion behind her. Because of how her lap portion of the belt was riding, she sustained what we call a lap belt injury or seat belt syndrome. And I'll show you a slide, essentially, which describes what had happened. If you notice, in a booster seat, the lap portion of the seat belt rides on the hip where the bones are, as Gail had mentioned. But in her case, it was riding at her abdomen. Her spinal cord, because of this, was in effect severed at the waist, functionally. She also had significant injuries, including a transected small bowel, a lacerated liver, and a shattered kidney. She suffered a brain concussion, as well as multiple rib fractures and pulmonary contusions, which are bruises of her lungs. I don't know if you can see the screen clearly, but this kind of shows an MRI of her. If you notice, this is the front, this is her back. Along here is the vertebral column, and you can see the spinal cord behind. Now, spinal cord should have a uniform color all the way down. As you can see, right around the first lumbar spine, there's an abnormality, and the smooth contour of her backbone is also lost. A picture that I think probably makes it even more clear is the loss in that contour of her vertebral column, where you can kind of see it sticking out. This is what we call a chance fracture, which is a fracture dislocation of that of her spinal column. And you can, you can see where the spinal cord looks fairly abnormal. This is a picture of a chest x-ray And you can imagine there are tubes running, one in her trachea in her to help her breathe, tubes in her stomach, and I think you can also see rods. This is after surgery, that's in her spinal column. Another picture essentially revealing those same rods, and then a number of all the tubes that she had placed in her. And imagine, if you can, if this was your own child, your nephew, your niece, grandchild, having to have all this done to them. Here's a photograph that kind of shows those same tubes, but this time a photograph of brain. So, because of the injuries that she sustained, she had to have multiple surgeries to repair her small bowel, and then she subsequently, because the kidney was shattered, she had to have her right kidney removed. Her gallbladder also had to be removed. She had her appendix removed, and as has been described by Julie, over the course of her hospitalization, she suffered a lot of pain, and as the realization of what had happened to her began to kick in, a lot of days of sadness, but not only for her but for her family, as they could see the potential of what had been lost. And by the time, as Julie had mentioned, she was leaving, she was not really actually able to tolerate food, just because she had a severe ileus situation, where because of the bowel injury and the surgery she had to have, her bowels weren't moving, and so she couldn't tolerate feed. However, she was able to improve and go to rehab and eventually home to her family. Based upon the significant amount of research that has been done throughout this country, and my personal experience in taking care of patients that have suffered injuries caused by an improperly placed seatbelt, it is clear that the child cannot safely use an adult seatbelt alone until they are minimum, as recommended now, of height of 4 feet 9 inches. Many children will reach that height by age 8, and so that is the law in a majority of other states. It is my medical opinion that the law in our state should cover children until they reach the age of 8. We should be also educating children and their families during these booster years that they need to use the type of restraint that will give them the most protection, even beyond age 8 if necessary. The case for securing a child properly in a motor vehicle is compelling. You have heard a lot of the statistics provided. 48% of children between the ages of 4 and 8 who were killed in motor vehicle crashes were unrestrained properly. Using a booster seat with a safety belt instead of just a safety belt alone will reduce the chance of a child's injury by about 60%. I hope that I never have to treat another child with the injuries brain experienced. As a physician, my goal is to restore a child to their pre-injury quality of life. Unfortunately, my colleagues and I cannot always do this when the injury involves the brain or the spinal cord. The only cure for these types of injuries is prevention, and the best prevention tool we have in this case is a booster seat. This really, ladies and gentlemen, is not about politics. The science is really clear. Indeed, the only statistic I want you to think about is one, brain, or could it be your nephew, your niece, your grandchild, your own child that would have to go through this. As Gail showed, we are now one of only 6 states that do not have a proper booster seat law enacted. You have the opportunity to make a difference in the lives of Minnesota's children. Help pass this bill into law, and hopefully because of that, you will effectively have reduced the likelihood that another child will suffer as a brain has. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Krager. We have one more testifier, and that's Sergeant Joellen Rustin. I hope I pronounced that correctly, from the Apple Valley Police Department. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name again is Joellen Rustin, and I'm a sergeant with the Apple Valley Police Department. I've been a law enforcement professional for the past 19 years, and it is my privilege to represent the law enforcement community over this very important issue. Many of the duties in my career as a police officer have revolved around specialized assignments in traffic safety and community programs, including child passenger safety. I am a nationally certified child passenger safety instructor and a member of the Child Passenger Safety Advisory Board through the Minnesota Office of Traffic Safety, and most importantly, I am the mother of two. I'm involved in the national certification training for child passenger safety technicians, the state-mandated child passenger safety training for daycare and foster care providers, and I routinely answer questions from the public with regard to child passenger safety. We know that parents look to the law to dictate their behavior, and unfortunately, when we tell them, the law specifies child restraints are needed until a child reaches age 4. They feel that it is a rite of passage to a seatbelt. They believe it's okay and that it is safe. We as child passenger safety advocates know that putting a child in an adult seatbelt that does not fit them properly is not safe and could in fact be deadly. As a law enforcement officer, I've seen injuries and deaths sustained by children who were not properly restrained in motor vehicle crashes. And I've also seen the absence of injuries to children who were properly restrained. And because of this, we propose a change in the law, bringing the age to under 8 or 4'9" as the requirements for proper restraint. Adopting this change is an opportunity to make parents and caregivers aware of the proper and safest way to restrain children in a motor vehicle. The desire of law enforcement is compliance in this very important matter. We would rather see compliance than the tragedies that could come from failure to properly restrain a child in a motor vehicle. In order to gain compliance, we will continue our educational efforts. However, some parents may still choose to violate the law. In this case, enforcement is the remedy. Any enforcement of this addition to the child restraint law would be handled just as the present law is. The present statute has a specific age requirement, but has always been handled by a common sense approach and simply asking the parents for the needed information. Parents would not need to worry about having a birth certificate to prove age or a tape measure to show height. Education and awareness is just as important as enforcement when it comes to the stated goal of traffic safety. A clear and appropriate statute can help accomplish all these goals. As Minnesota's elected officials, you have the opportunity to follow the example of 44 other states and strengthen our state's child restraint law. With your help, we see a future that does not involve walking up to the scene of a crash and see a child killed or severely injured unnecessarily because they were not properly restrained. Car crashes kill more children between the ages of 4 and 8 than anything else. Seat belts save lives, but a seat belt that doesn't fit properly will not protect a child in a crash. The cost of a backless booster is a mere $12 to $18. Less than half a tank of gas. That's a very small price to pay for the safety of our children. And as proactive as we are in our efforts, we cannot possibly reach every parent or caregiver who transports children. A change in the law would have a significant impact on the safety of the children of the state of Minnesota. The current law is outdated, and the state support will enable us to reduce the number of traffic-related injuries and deaths of Minnesota children. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee.
Thank you, Sergeant Rustin. Members, we have, before we get into the discussion, there is one housekeeping item that we should do, and that is there is an amendment to this bill, which I'd like to just move so we can get it in the form that the author would like it. It's the A1 amendment. Then once we dispose of this, then we can have Q&A of the author and any testifiers. So, members, if you have the H0267A1 amendment, Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Our fabulous House Research Analyst, Matt Burris, noticed that there was a conforming change that needed to be made. If we change the age at which we place a child in a booster seat, then that affects another portion of Minnesota statute, which affects who you buckle up in the back seat. And this just says if they're not in a child restraint, then you buckle them up. And so we don't have a situation where we let anybody fall between the cracks.
Thank you. To the amendments, Representative Ortman moves the 267A1 amendment. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, the motion carries, and we have the House file in the shape that the author wants it. Now, members, do you have, I know that Representative Erdahl has a question. Again, we're directing questions to any of the testifiers and the author of the bill. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'd like the police sergeant to come down as well, please. My question is for her and to Representative Portman. Sergeant, you seem to suggest that what I'm wondering, I'll get right to this, is that if you're under 4'9", would you be safer if you didn't use a seatbelt?
No. No, absolutely not.
Okay. Maybe, I don't know if Representative Portman or the sergeant can answer this. Currently, we have a seatbelt law in Minnesota. We have, I think, about roughly 87% compliance. Do you know what the compliance rate is for use of child restraints now?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erdahl, the 87% compliance is only for drivers in the front seat of vehicles. It doesn't apply to people restrained in the back seat because current statute doesn't allow or doesn't require the use of seat belts after the age of 10 in the back seat. We have seen with the latest survey from the Department of Public Safety that while 90% of parents are aware of the importance of child passenger restraint devices, fewer than 50% actually use them after the age of 4.
Representative Erdahl.
So, Mr. Chairman, all right, you're saying that less than 50% under the age of 4 use them.
Over the age of 4, between the 4 and 7 or 8 age group that we're talking about.
Okay. With this law, then, would you expect an increase in compliance?
That would be the expectation, Mr. Chair.
Okay, just, I think that this is...
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think it's probably a pretty good idea, but I'm wondering if some of the circumstances out there that might be unforeseen. You have a squirt hockey team or a slumber party or something, and you're transporting children. Would this be everybody brings their own booster seats with them, or what do you envision in situations like that where you're carpooling or whatever?
In an ideal world, that would be the case. We understand law enforcement has discretion with regard to enforcement. So individual circumstances like that, they would have the discretion whether to enforce or not.
Representative Erdahl,
Representative Portman.
The way that the law is currently drafted, with the current booster seat requirement, you only have to have a booster seat in a seat where there's a seat belt installed. So theoretically, you could, if you have kids in between, they wouldn't be required to be in a booster seat. Then they would just be violating the other part of Minnesota law that says if a kid is under 10, you have to buckle them up. But you can't get pulled over for it. This you can get pulled over for as a primary offense, the booster seat part, but buckling up the kids in the back seat, you can't get pulled over for. But that's what the bill says. I mean, I'm not advocating that approach, but that's what the law would require.
All right, thanks. Thank you, Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Portman, I appreciate you bringing this bill. In a former life, I was an attorney, and I had one of my worst cases involved a case just like this. And the lesson I walked away with was to stop being a lawyer, because these cases are so deeply troubling. And number two, do everything you can to educate about child restraint seats. And so I thank Lynn and her family as well for their courage. We tried to do this last year, and I'm glad you're bringing it again this year. And I I appreciate the officer's distinction between enforcement and education. Government can do good. And one of the good things government can do is it can educate folks, raise the awareness. You know, Representative Riddle, I think that's a fair point you raise. I think we already see our law enforcement exercising discretion for children 0 through 4 with the child restraint that's already required under law. And I would trust our law enforcement. I think Representative Cornish indicates he would trust our law enforcement to make those decisions on the spot. But it's the educational function, members, that brings me to sign on to this bill. I've been involved in this directly. I cringe when I hear the nanny state argument raised, because I would ask those who would be inclined to do so to talk with Bren, her family, talk with me, talk with others, for whom just a little more education would have been tremendously beneficial. So thank you.
Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I don't know how many times I've heard this bill, and so I'm sorry I have to ask this because I should know this, but I can't remember. Would this violation be subject to the surcharge of, I think, what is it, $70-some now?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, I don't know that, but I do know that we'll be going to the Public Safety Policy Committee, and I'll know before I get to that committee, but I can get back to you on this. When I looked at the fiscal note, I didn't see money going to the general fund. There's a fiscal note that's been pulled because there was an error, and we'll be dealing with that at, I believe, the Public Safety Finance Committee. The erroneous one said about $3,000, so that's why we weren't too concerned about waiting for the recalculation. Also, this is a policy committee. But when I looked at the where all the money went from the violations that they presumed would happen, I don't think any of it went into the general fund.
Well, Mr. Chair, much of that surcharge is all goes to special pots of money. I'm not sure any of it actually even goes to the weird places that it goes, libraries,
emergency,
and brain injury.
Professional
and
training, yeah.
Right, so, I guess I wish I would know the answer to that. Does Mr. Burris know the answer?
Proactive. He already had his his book in front of him. So.
Well, I'm going to try what I did last time with this, and I don't think that Representative Hartman objected last time. But you know, I'm listening carefully to this, and Representative Morrow, you and I probably have different definitions of nanny states and valid roles of government, etc. And I don't think there's anybody in this room, no matter how they feel about the bill, want to see kids injured. And some of us believe in, you know, personal responsibility and knowing things as a parent, in addition to keeping your kids safe in the car, feeding them properly, all kinds of things that we don't have laws about that we expect parents to do without having a law specific to that. And so what I would like to do is make sure that the fine must be waived, take the discretion out. And so that if a ticket is issued for this, the violation of booster or safety seats, that if the individual driver that's been ticketed produces within 14 days proof that they have a booster seat by purchase or borrowing or whatever to the law enforcement agent, just similar to what we do with some of our fix-it tickets, that then the fine would be waived, and so that we wouldn't cause there to be a burden relative to this. And so the amendment would be on line 1.18, change may to must, and on line 1.19, delete or the amount reduced. So it would read, the fine must be waived if the motor vehicle operator produces evidence that within 14 days, yada, yada, yada.
Hey, members, I have Representative Pulaski ringing in my ear saying, is this the jurisdiction of this committee? But I will waive that. We'll do this amendment here. But members, we'll discuss it here. But I think in the future we should try to keep our amendments germane to the committee, because that's probably more of a public safety policy and finance kind of question. But we'll do it here. But that's just to remind members, this bill is going next to public safety policy. So Do we have, you want to move that amendment, Representative Holbert?
I thought I just did.
Or, I mean, we have the amendment before us. Is there discussion? Does the author want to respond?
Representative Hornstein, members, that's a friendly amendment.
Okay. Is there discussion? Okay, all in favor of the Holberg oral amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, the motion prevails. So we have now two amendments incorporated into the bill. Is there further discussion about the bill? Further testimony? I see maybe some conversation. Okay. Well, with that, members, I think we are ready to vote on House File 267, and our motion is to Representative Fortman will renew her motion to pass House File 267 as amended to the Public Safety Policy Committee. Representative Holbrook, you have a concern with
that? Chair Hillstrom's committee?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, the motion prevails, and the motion prevails. So we do have with the one vote, no vote. So, members, thank you very much for a good discussion, and appreciate.
If I could just thank the members for voting in favor and the pretty muted opposition, but I would just ask that when we do debate this issue on the floor of the House, will you please think back to this committee hearing and what you heard there? I think that you have a different perspective on this bill because of being on this committee and having heard the testimony. And so when we do debate it on the House floor, just think back to the information that was presented here. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Horman. Thank you to all the witnesses that came, and we appreciate your good testimony. Members, we're going to, while we make a transition now into our MnDOT presentations, we do have the minutes from February 3rd that we would like to have moved, and there is one change. There was a typo. It wasn't February 28th. This isn't Back to the Future or the Future Back or whatever. But it's the minutes of February 3rd. I'll make that oral amendment, and then we'll have Representative Champion move the minutes today.
I move that we accept the minutes as amended and corrected.
Okay. All in favor of Representative Champion's motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, the motion prevails. Okay. We've got a no vote noted again. And
this is Chairman. I want to switch my vote from no to yes, but you got to give people the chance to say no.
All right. Okay.
I know there's usually peace in the Ballinger committee, but not always.
The chairman will note that and will delay his gavel on future votes. members, we are going to continue. We had a very patient Mike Schadauer at the last hearing, and there were about, I think, three or four slides that you wanted to get through, and we might have had some additional questions. And members, this is the conclusion of the Greater Minnesota Transit discussion, and I'll call on Mr. Schadauer to conclude his presentation that we started at the last meeting.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, committee members. At the last presentation, I was discussing the MnDOT Office of Transit and what we're planning for next year. I did essentially make it through that presentation. I think what remained was the opportunity for you to make comments and questions. So given that, I've invited Tom Gottfried, who's the manager of our program management area of our office, to join me because I'm still fairly new to the office, and he will be able to address your questions with me as best as possible. So. I would invite any questions you would have.
I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, we've essentially finished that presentation
okay.
last time. What I skipped was things about the rail plan that we'll be discussing shortly,
okay.
So we're ready for questions.
Okay, members, I know that we're all trying to rewind here and get to our saved items from last week. But are there any additional questions of members? I know that there was some information that I think Representative Morrow was interested in last week concerning the needs question. And we can maybe proceed with that. Or
well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know, Mr. Shadar, I asked you some questions. I think maybe it was in part concerning page 5 of your presentation, the Greater Minnesota Transit Plan bus service hours. And we were talking about need. I do have a couple of questions, but I think I also asked for a little bit of information. But the questions were, in part, number one, who set 80% of need as the goal for Greater Minnesota Transit?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to invite Tom to answer that one, because I believe that was set before I started.
You wouldn't be both. I had the distinct honor of being around when that was being done, and the consultant at the time that we were doing the Greater Minnesota Transit Plan in 2001, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I got to remember my etiquette, I apologize, is in 2001 there was a Greater Minnesota Transit Plan, and at that time, as the consultant was going through and identifying the various different levels of service and service needs out there in Greater Minnesota, it was determined in through the public hearing and through the process that was at that time for that plan to be adopted, that 80% was a good target for us to initiate our objectives, and hence that chart was created from that.
Mr. Chair? In 2001, was 80% considered a reachable number, and if so, by what year?
The plan at that point in time identified that by the year, Mr. Chair, members, sorry,
Mr. Godfrey.
In 2001, it was identified that by the year 2010, next year, that we were to achieve a number that was identified at that time roughly at 1.4 million hours of service hours, and that would represent 80% of the total need.
Mr. Chair, if I may then follow up, I'm looking again at that slide. It's dated January 9th, 2009. Does that reflect the governor's cut in funding that's proposed to Greater Minnesota Transit?
Mr. Chair, Representative Moreau, what you see there on the bars towards the bottom of that chart that get to a 1.03 million service hours per year reflects what we anticipate we'll be able to fund, including the governor's proposed cuts for the next biennium.
Everything more? Okay. Thank you. We also have a question from Representative Swales.
One, Mr. Chair, but thank you. I am curious if, since you were last with us, if there has been any updates from the federal government related to any stimulus projects or dollars related to your plan. Are you feeling like a little bit more optimistic that maybe there will be something coming from the federal government to help with this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wells, yeah, we've been talking to the Federal Transit Administration about the transit part of the economic recovery plan. Their estimate is that what we could expect to see in terms of federal money coming to Greater Minnesota would be essentially an equivalent of what we receive every year. So we receive approximately $15 million of federal funds that gets channeled to Greater Minnesota, so we could receive an extra $15 million through that economic recovery program.
So if this is in addition to, then how would this offset any of the projects that you have here? Would it be able to, could you move forward a little more quickly on some things? What is your discussion?
The funding would be for capital projects, so it doesn't directly help operations, but it allows us to push funding towards buses, towards transit facilities such as garages, transfer facilities, fare boxes, intelligent transportation system improvements. So those are the kinds of things that we'll be able to achieve with that help our transit systems as a whole. In some cases, that might allow them to reduce some operating costs because they can do things more efficiently with the new capital items that they're able to purchase.
Thank you. Members, are there any other questions or comments that anyone would like to make about our conversation on the Greater Minnesota Transit Plan? Yes, Representative Welty, sorry about that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to make a comment to all of the members. Last week, I believe it was last week, that it was St. Cloud Days at the Capitol, And I went over to the Kelly Inn to meet some of the folks from St. Cloud, and I was surprised. There they had the presence from the transit system in St. Cloud. And it just kind of shed light on the importance, because I know that Duluth has a transit system, Rochester has a transit system, and I believe it was mentioned in the committee last week that Grand Forks, possibly La Crescent, they all have transit systems, Mankato does. And sometimes we think of Litchfield, and sometimes we just think of transit being something that's in Minneapolis, St. Paul, in the suburbs. And it affects all of us in greater Minnesota as well. Not only do our larger regional areas, but also the small communities. Plainview and Elgin, the communities I represent, they have transit service a couple times a week. And it helps our seniors live independently and maintain their independent lifestyle in those rural communities. And so greater Minnesota transit is very, very important, just as important as the transit services that you all provide in the metropolitan area. And so I hope we keep that in mind as we move forward and we're looking at the recommendations that are coming from the governor's office in regards to transit.
And Representative Welty, thank you for that statement. That's precisely why I wanted to make sure that we had this presentation and gave it the time due. We have a lot of issues in greater Minnesota with transit, and you're absolutely right. I think that everyone just assumes we're talking about metro transit. There's a lot more to it than that. Representative Moore, did you have a final comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I wanted to remind Mr. Schadauer, there was a question I think I asked right at the end of last week about MnDOT contracts that were let late, resulting in late payments to transit systems in greater Minnesota. There are some cash flow problems. I don't know if I'm pulling an Erdahl or a Ruka Vina here, pulling out a newspaper article. Trailblazer Transit has announced that it's cutting service. Reductions are in response to MnDOT's reduction in funding for the Sibley and McLeod County Transit System. I don't know if the two things are related, Mr. Shadar, but I'd like to know how many systems are going to be affected by the late payments from MnDOT for transit for greater Minnesota.
Mr. Chair, Representative Moreau, I'm going to start the answer and ask Tom to follow up with some of the more individual transit provider issues. We put out 65 different transit contracts on January 19th, so it was later than we normally do. Normally that's getting out in the December timeframe. We wanted to make sure that we didn't put anything more in those contracts than what transit providers could expect to use this year, so that they were managing their resources properly. As of today, we've gotten 40 of those contracts back, and they're fully executed, and we've made the first payment on 40 of those 65. We still have 25 to go. It will depend on how quickly the transit providers are able to turn their end around, and we understand that it takes them a while, because sometimes they have to go through boards to get permission to execute a contract on their end. So they're still going through that process in some areas. We're turning these around as quickly as we possibly can in our office. Perhaps Tom can address the specific provider that Representative Moreau mentioned.
Actually, I can probably list off a few other ones that you were probably concerned about as well. There is a fair number of transit properties that are rather transit-dependent on our funding flow as it comes into us. And statutorily, we are required to put out our state funds in the 50% payments for the general fund, which is supposed to help take care of the cash flow in the first part of the year. The challenge right now is some of the systems in the delay have a little bit of that problem, but some of the cash flow issues are going to be affecting some of the private nonprofit organizations we deal with. That would be the CAP agencies. We got roughly about 13 to 15 properties that we are concerned about cash flow. Trailblazer just being one of those numbers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will wrap up. I appreciate the committee members' indulgence, if you will, and I appreciate your answers. As I think I mentioned, Mr. Schadauer, there is no Met Council for greater Minnesota. You guys are it, I think. There's no one here advocating. We didn't spend, we don't have a group coming before us for a day. You all have to advocate for greater Minnesota transit. I respect your answers, of course. I think that greater Minnesota transit is being underfunded. I think that we've set a need goal that was inadequate, and we're inadequately meeting that inadequate goal. I don't blame you. I appreciate your answers, but the message I hope is clear. We have to do a better job for the very reasons that Representative Welty is saying. Mr. Shadar, you shared some excellent information with me about the need to coordinate Minnesota Transit in Greater Minnesota, and that the cost was, at least initially, approximately $300,000, or I should be more specific. MnDOT, I understand, has applied for a United We Ride grant of $300,000 to begin the coordination problem, because members, we have folks who can get to the border of their county, they can't cross the border on that van or bus. They've got to get on another bus, or call someone else, or wait in a parking lot. So I do hope for $300,000 we can at least get this coordination going, and maybe some of these efficiencies, because we have vans that are half full driving partway, and we have other areas that don't have vans at all. So members, thank you very much. Thank you for your answers, and I look forward to hearing about some improvements as the state transit plan progresses.
Thank you. And members, I think at this point we will transition into the discussion of the rail plan with Mr. Christensen. And as we make that transition, Representative Riddle is exempt from this, but we have a little quiz I want to get to the committee just to make sure we're listening to each other. Can anyone respond? What is the proposed commuter line going west towards Litchfield? What's that called? What's the name of it? Yes, Representative Welty.
I believe it's Little Crow.
Correct. Ding, 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 ding. So, good. We'll be quizzing each other on our priorities as the year progresses. Very good. Very good. So, with that, let me just give the members a little bit of a... Yes, Representative
Mr. Chairman, encouraging Representative Erdahl only makes it work.
Yeah, well,
speaking from experience, you haven't been to one of our caucuses.
Representative Welty is ahead here on correct answers, but Representative Zellers, I think there's a particular project in your district that we might have to quiz people on. But members, just to give people some context for this discussion, I am an alternate on the Midwest High Speed Passenger Rail Commission. Representative Slocum is our House designee to that. Senator Sieben is the designee in the Senate, and Senator Bonhoff is the alternate. And we were together at a conference in Omaha in December, and it was really impressed upon us there how important this completion of this rail plan is for us to be able to access federal monies, not only for high-speed rail, but for other passenger rail projects. Now, the rail plan is not just passenger rail. We'll be hearing about freight as well. But the reason I was very interested in getting a much more specific, in-depth discussion about the rail plan beyond what we would have had normally is that this is very, very critical to the high-speed rail project and other projects. This has been delayed, and I think we're finally getting going on this. Commissioner Sorrell was at this meeting in Omaha, and I know he was very committed to getting it done. So members, this is our opportunity to get a much more in-depth discussion going about the rail plan, and I know several of you have come to me already with questions. So what I'd like to do is if we can get the overview done in 10 to 15 minutes tops, and then I'll spend the rest of the meeting, we'll have entertaining the questions of members. So even 12 minutes would be great. So welcome back to the committee, Mr. Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, my name is Dave Christensen. I'm the manager of freight planning and development in the Office of Freight and Commercial Vehicle Operations, and also the project manager for the statewide rail plan. I'd like to reintroduce Mr. Mike Shadower. He's co-project manager in charge of the passenger portion of the rail plan, as well as the passenger rail forum, which is currently active. I'm going to just go through quickly and give you some background and overview, as well as a quick summary of where we stand on the rail plan. Just some quick definitions so that we all are on the same page as what rail is. We have light rail transit, like the Hiawatha Rail Line. A lot of people consider that to be rail, but for the purpose of the state rail plan, that will be outside the venue of what we look at for intercity rail, rather as part of the transit network. We have heavy rail transit that some of you are aware of, the Chicago L, New York Subway, suburban commuter runs. That is something also that is in rail and transit, but also considered part of the rail picture, vernacular. Commuter rail is short-distance conventional locomotive-run trains or self-propelled trains that operate on freight railroads or existing normal conventional right-of-way that move short distances and bring people on their trips to work. North Star Rail is a prime example of that, and one that we'll have operating soon. Intercity rail is medium and long-distance trains. That includes the Amtrak National Network. It includes a host of intercity trains sponsored by states around the country. There are 18 states that have intercity rail trains right now, either operated by Amtrak or by the states, operating between city pairs for medium distances from 200 to 500 miles. Intercity rail, which is going to be part of the passenger realm of the comprehensive rail plan, is considered in three different speed categories for the purpose of the study. One is traditional rail, like Amtrak. The speeds by federal law don't go any higher than 80 miles per hour. On a conventional freight railroad, it's the highest quality of track and structure. That is what is allowable under Federal Railroad Administration rules for the last 20 years. Incremental improvements we're looking at and that are not considered by the Federal Railroad Administration as true high-speed rail, but one that we consider high-speed when we're talking about it in the realm of state operations, is from 80 miles per hour up to 110 miles per hour. When we talk about Midwest high-speed rail or Northern Lights Express high-speed rail between Duluth and Minneapolis, we're looking at 110 miles per hour top speed, so we're in that range. True high-speed rail, like what some of you are familiar with overseas, the TGV in France, the ICE system in Germany, a lot of other industrialized countries, is anything higher than 110 miles per hour. And it's important to note here that for the Federal Railroad Administration's definitions, 124 miles per hour is their threshold between intermediate and high-speed rail. And at 124 miles per hour, you have to go to a segregated, grade-separated right-of-way. That is, you have no at-grade crossings between road and rail. Everything is separated. The railroad has an uninhibited path between the stations, and the roads go overhead or below. Current Minnesota service is the Amtrak Empire Builder, one train per day in each direction.
Yes, Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What happens when it gets to Spokane? How does it go two different directions? Is that one train, you know, alternating trains, or how does that work?
And Mr. Chair, Representative Hobson, at Spokane, Amtrak puts on a second locomotive, splits off essentially three or four cars from the 18-car train, and then sends the main train to Seattle and the subsidiary train to Portland, and they do the reverse coming eastbound.
Representative Erdahl. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Wrong committee. Mr. Christensen, just wondering on the speeds, if they're going 80 miles an hour, do they slow down at towns?
Under federal law, at this point, Mr. Chair and Representative, currently, speed restrictions on the main line are strictly for structural restrictions and safety restrictions. Any railroad operating as a Class 1 freight railroad or passenger railroad in the country does not have to slow down for a city, but they do have to slow down by federal regulation for curves, bridges, anything that inhibits the safety of the train itself.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. You can continue.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to just go through a few federal programs. Before 2008, there was one particular railroad enhancement program that was in the safety lieu category that involved intercity passenger rail service. $30 million was awarded last summer by the Federal Railroad Administration under this program as an ongoing grant for improvements. 50-50 match was part of the ruling there. Minnesota did get two grants out of this, $1 million for the Duluth-Minneapolis high-speed rail line for their environmental assessment, and several hundred thousand dollars for high-speed rail improvements near La Crescent on the river corridor for Amtrak. This basically supports projects to reduce delays and to reduce congestion on existing passenger rail and to promote passenger rail. so it's a very generic category. New federal programs came about last October with the 2008 State Rail Safety Enhancement Act. This occurred just literally 2 weeks after the deadly crash in Los Angeles where 25 people were killed on a Metrolink passenger train, commuter train. Five bills that were active in Congress at that time were all rolled together and passed. Several things that come out of that besides hazardous materials regulations and safety regulations, signal regulations for the railroads, included some new federal funding. The first one that we're going to go over here is a fund for intercity rail service. Before this point in time, Amtrak would provide funding to help start up intercity state-sponsored trains, but there was no formula for it and a very small fund within the Amtrak budget. This set up a $1.9 billion fund over the next 5 years to enhance and improve and expand intercity rail service. Like it says, for acquiring track structure trains and doing the planning and engineering for these intercity state-sponsored rail plans. Again, this is conventional rail, essentially below 80 miles per hour. The Rail Safety Enhancement Act also had congestion grants. These are essentially grants that mimic the safety lieu grants that we were awarded money from this last summer, basically for improving rail passenger service in various generic categories. The last group from this new Rail Act is $1.5 billion over 5 years to promote specifically high-speed rail, 110 miles per hour and above, on corridors all over the country. Up to 18 corridors were designated as possible recipients of money, but again, this is for either Amtrak, state-sponsored, or other high-speed rail initiatives to promote them and to start getting something literally on the tracks, no pun intended. Minnesota projects that we have going on right now, we have the Midwest Regional Rail Initiative. Some of you are aware of that and know it as Midwest High-Speed Regional Rail Initiative. The Northern Lights Express between Duluth and Minneapolis that is on its third year and already approaching environmental assessment as the next project step. And another Minnesota project that are very active at this point is a Rochester inclusion in the Midwest Regional Rail Initiative as an alternative alignment for the high-speed trains. And, of course, St. Paul Union Depot, which was granted $50 million 2 years ago to begin development as a regional hub for rail and transit. Midwest Regional Rail Initiative is a 9-state system centered around Chicago with speeds at 110 miles per hour. It just received $300,000 last summer from the grants and funds that were passed in order to keep up their planning and promotion. This at 110 miles per hour would put a train from St. Paul into Chicago in 5.5 hours versus the 8 hours that it currently takes. Our share in $2,002 for the Minnesota leg would be $400 million out of a rough total cost of about $1.9 billion. And of course you need to inflate that very seriously for today's dollars. This is a map showing the line. If you look at that carefully, the three lines in Illinois, the lines in Indiana, the lines in Michigan, and the lines in Wisconsin up to Milwaukee are already operating with intercity rail trains that are state-sponsored. In some cases, like Michigan, they are transitioning into 110 mile per hour high-speed corridors. Iowa and Minnesota are the only states that do not have rail operations in place at this point among the 9 states for intercity passenger rail. So we are stepping up to that. Iowa just last session passed a law to propose and contract with Amtrak to study 3 corridors in their state.
Mr. Christensen, I'm very glad you brought that up. That was a question. That was a question I had again coming out of that meeting we were at in Omaha. Is the rail plan going to examine and deal with the costs and benefits of having the state do, for example, the Duluth line, a possible line to Rochester, as state operated in partnership with Amtrak type of routes, which I understand are very common in Illinois and these other states that you mentioned?
Mr. Chair, yes, it will study all those corridors separately and the Midwest Rail as well, both high speed and conventional.
Okay, and then one quick follow up from there. Has there been discussion about, my understanding also is that when requested by states, Amtrak will also do concurrent or separate studies of these lines. Apparently there
have any requests now, but is that also something that's been discussed or considered?
Mr. Chair, we have discussed that. We have not moved ahead in the past as a state to request Amtrak to do that. There are some contractual costs with Amtrak, but basically we have to commit to a possible rail service before they will study options within the state as an Amtrak-operated operation.
Okay. Thank you.
Northern Lights Express, fourth dimension, already Duluth to Minneapolis. Again, it's aimed at speeds up to 110 miles per hour for a two-hour trip between the city pair. It received $1.1 million this last summer from the $30 million federal. And it's looking at a cost between $360 to $520 million for full capital expenditures, purchase of train sets, and startup of operations. And those are in 2006 dollars. It does not include station development along the line, but everything else. This is a map showing it. The extensions on there also show North Star and some possible commuter operations that are being considered by local agencies up on the North Shore. Rochester, of course, is also very active at this point, both in the rail forum and on their own. They have formed the Olmsted County Regional Railroad Association and are partnering with the River Cities on determining the alignment and promoting high-speed rail. And at this point, they are looking very seriously at what alignments they can use to offer as an option for the 110-mile line.
Has a question or a comment on that?
I have a comment on that, Mr. Chair. I want to thank Mr. Christensen and Mr. Schadauer for acknowledging all the work that we've been doing in southeastern Minnesota. And just for the members around this table, I won't go through the comments that I made yesterday in the Finance Committee or all of the comments, but I think it's critical that we, as we move forward on this and they're determining where this high-speed rail line is going to go, that we examine all of the alternatives. When you look at it, you know, Rochester is the third largest city in Minnesota. We have the largest private employer in the state with almost 30,000 people employed at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester. You just look at the economics, the ridership, and the speed. I think all that has to be analyzed when we look at where it's going to ultimately end up. And I'll just make one closing comment, and that is that, you know, the congressional delegation, with the exception of McCollum, because she's already stated her support for the St. Paul corridor, which makes a lot of sense because she represents that area. But some of the other congressional members are saying, you know, we're waiting for the state to come up with their statewide rail plan. So they're really looking to the state to determine transit and routes in within the state. So I think it's a critical time that we're studying this.
To that end, Mr. Chair, it does occur to me that before that study's done, you perhaps do Rochester a disservice by putting any line on the map, because if you focus on a line that potentially is the most expensive, what I heard him say is they want to examine all the alternatives, and so we don't want to box them in by suggesting we're only looking at one. So I think I don't know how you do that map, but it seems to me that might be something you want to consider.
Yeah,
if you're interested in examining all the alternatives, to just be careful about the map we put.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you'll note, those are straight lines in there that do not follow any current rail alignment, so it's strictly a placeholder on the rail planning. We fully recognize that, and we're sensitive to that issue. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Leader.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and Mr. Christensen, where did the DMME terminate on going east to the river? Where would it hit the Canadian Pacific?
Yes. Mr. Chair,
Citizens
Representative, the DMME coming through Rochester starts at Owatonna, comes straight west through Rochester and terminates in Winona, ties into the Canadian Pacific at that point.
Yes, Winona.
Yep. Canadian Pacific right there. Okay. So thank you. Well, maybe if you could conclude,
yep.
You only have a couple more slides.
Right. Moving forward, Mr. Chair, St. Paul Union Depot mentioned that's a $50 million grant that will be developing the concourse and transit areas of St. Paul Union Depot as a regional hub. Amtrak and inner city buses may be calling in there as early as 2012, depending on what happens with the post office. And of course, the Central Corridor LRT station is scheduled to be placed on 4th Street right in front of the station. And this is just some pictures of how it will look both in front of the head house and back when tracks are reestablished. Now, on the rail plan itself, we had a 2008 directive mandate to proceed with a comprehensive freight and passenger rail plan by MnDOT. It covers all aspects and areas of the state and both the existing system and proposed passenger system. We went ahead after determining where the funding would come from and looking at other states' efforts, doing some research and determining the size and scope. We actually went ahead and proactively held an RFP scoping session with a dozen key stakeholders on rail projects, freight railroads, and freight interests around the state, with Commissioner Sorrell in attendance and participating. From the results of that, and with the federal law passing in October that has 3 pages of state rail plan requirements written into it, we went ahead. We did a revised scope. We passed that by our legislative representatives that had been assigned to the Policy Advisory Committee at our request, and then released the RFP for proposals in December.
Okay, Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Christensen. This has been helpful information. It took us to this slide to see the word freight. And I know that my friends maybe in the Chamber of Commerce, Mr. Christensen and others might want to know a little bit more about what MnDOT's doing in terms of freight. There's a passenger rail forum. There's a state rail group. I think that group met in October, the freight representatives, but I don't know that you've convened since then. Could you give us a little more information about what MnDOT's plans and processes are for freight rail?
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative Morrow. On the October 3rd meeting, which was a one-time meeting, we did have freight representatives in full attendance there. On the passenger rail forum, we have left the structure in the bylaws open that if we have any solicitations or interim interests that rail forum will be addressing, that we will invite freight interests to the table so that they have a full say there. The railroads themselves are already present at that forum. As we move ahead with the plan itself, we are doing a dual-track process so that we don't lose the freight voice. We're going to have a freight study as we move ahead, and we will have a passenger study. Their interests are obviously very, very different, and we have a lot of freight programs to evaluate, as well as the interests such as captive shippers and service levels and short lines that we need to establish. We will be integrating those two study tracks as we move toward the end of the process.
Quick follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Christensen, if you could just include freight maps when you do rail presentations, that'd be very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the two testifiers, I've been reviewing quite a few of the past rail studies that were done in Minnesota, and I just had noticed in some of the studies that I have alluded to that this point has been brought up before and it's been brought up in the past, but I don't know if anything was ever done about it. So two questions related to past points that I've read about in the 80 study and 90 study. Intermodal, are we focusing on intermodal and expansion of intermodal transport on rail throughout the state? And then abandoned rail lines. Do we have still a funding source in the state where we acquire abandoned rail lines so that we're not losing that potential source for a commuter rail system or freight rail system in the future if we ever need them back?
Mr. Chair, Representative, on the second of those questions, we do have a Minnesota Rail Bank program. We currently, as DOT, own 4 rail corridors in the state. DNR owns considerably more mileage of past trails, and then there are the regional railroad associations that own the large balance of that. We have almost 4,000 miles of trails or right-of-way that are preserved in the state. On the issue of, what was your first question again?
Intermodal.
We are looking at intermodal both as an integrated portion of this freight plan for the rail plan. We are very much concerned that we do not have enough intermodal terminals and intermodal access in the state on several of the freight rail corridors. We're also looking at it in 2 freight plans that we are doing in the Red River Valley and in northern Minnesota at this point.
Representative Swales, and then we'll have Representative Zeller.
Thank you. I am very curious going along with Representative Welty's question. When we are trying to expand to high-speed rail, and what you were saying is that there's a whole different grading system, that in some cases you have to have a segregated rail so that it doesn't interface with other systems, what kind of of money are we talking about in order to do the land acquisition or to be able to change the grading so that we can really move from the current rail system that we have to a high-speed rail system?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that covers a wide range of prices. If we are looking at just upgrading an 80-mile-per-hour freight railroad to 110 miles per hour, that is in the category of $1 million to $3 million per mile to upgrade the track structure to make it available for that speed. That levels the rail, improves the tie structure, the roadbed, and signaling. If we move into true high-speed rail and look at separated alignments from the freight rail system, then we're talking about costs fairly similar to building an interstate system. You have to acquire right-of-way, 100 to several hundred feet wide, grading for essentially a level grade. In some cases, it's more expensive than an interstate because you have to have a graded structure that varies from the level no more than 0.5% over distance in order to achieve and maintain high speeds. And then, of course, power generation, safety, and everything else. So it's there's a possibility as we move into what France or Germany would look like in the future of being a fairly significant capital investment at the national level.
Thank you. Representative Zeller.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And maybe it's because I'm new to committee, but why was this, you said the DNR owns the vast majority of the rail lines or the excess that we bought up. Why does, maybe it's a dumb question, but why does the DNR own rail lines?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the reason for that is that most of the abandoned rail lines, the majority of the mileage that was abandoned were in very low-density areas and slightly traveled rail lines, and a lot of that is in state forest territory, particularly in the upper half of the state, and that is a simple reason why so much of it is reverted to DNR.
Representative Hausman.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, wouldn't it also be the rails to trails conversion?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, that is correct.
Representative Ellis, I want to make sure that you had all of your questions.
Yeah, no, I was wondering if that was the difference between being, if you picked up the rails and the ties, and it was just a...
Representative Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Christensen, the DNR trails that have been abandoned by the railroad, are they historically... You can't touch them, that they can't revert back, other than they maintain permanently in DNR control. That's my understanding.
Mr. Chair, Representative Leader, that depends entirely on the particular trail. The contractual purchase and the regulations of that rail trails, of course, can convert back. Some of the trails are held in fee simple and with restrictions on, so they cannot revert back to any other purpose than a recreational trail. Most of the trails, I won't say most, but the majority of trails in the state that were once active rail lines could be converted back to rail, but with some difficulty, obviously, with political pressure and environmental issues that would have to be addressed.
Thank you. Members, we're about to adjourn, but let me just make a suggestion if I can. On page 10, you're going to see of the handout, couple of very important process slides. This kind of relates to the makeup of the various groups that are involved in the plan. There's a MnDOT website listed here for committee members and the public. There's a timeline involving a kickoff next month, and of course we have the phone numbers of the various MnDOT staffers who are involved with this. You know, there's a lot of interest in this. Because this is an ongoing work in progress, I think there are many points where the legislature has an interest and our constituents have an interest. And what I'd like to do is, rather than continue this hearing next week, you know, you'll get to work, and perhaps before we... adjourn sine die, whenever that is. No, not sine die, but adjourn for the spring, maybe in April or May. we maybe have you back for an update on the progress report. Because, again, there's a lot of interest in this, and there's still, I think, questions out there. And I'll let Representative Houseman have the last word.
And, Mr. Chair, the one thing, and I don't know if I've said it to this group before, but they've certainly heard it, this ongoing concern I have about this dual track we're on with a state rail plan and a rail transportation forum, and for whatever reason, the Rail Transportation Forum was on a fast track. And for 8 months, we've done nothing on the other one. And that is, since one was asked for in statute and the other one wasn't, it is just bewildering to me how this happened. And I, because we have two parallel structures going, I just don't understand how eventually those plans aren't potentially going to conflict, and just observations more than anything, I guess.
And thank you. I think that's a question that's been on our minds. Representative Erdahl?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to add that they won't conflict in one area because the little crow line has been requested for both.
Representative Sellers, I'm going to have you. You have the last question, and I'll make a quick comment, and then we're going to adjourn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I went through the entire thing, and if we would have gotten as far as the one thing I think is missing, and if it can be for the group as we're going forward, is the cost-benefit analysis. I don't see anywhere in here where we're going to put into either the planning, the setting. It seems like we're just going to do it. We're not going to see if it makes sense financially for the state or for the communities that are going to be touched. And I don't see a cost-benefit analysis in any of the slides. Not that you should have, not that we asked, but going forward, I think that's a very important part of this, because we should know what we're getting for our money.
Mr. Christensen, will there be a cost-benefit analysis in the rail plan?
Mr. Chair, Representative, there will be. That will be key to our total analysis of both corridors and freight programs and projects.
Yeah.
Great.
And
thank you, Mr. Chair.
Members, also, I call your attention, there is a handout, a double-sided passenger rail planning update. They anticipated some of our questions, you know, I think the one that you know, concerns me is similar to Representative Houseman, and you know, maybe when we get a progress report in spring, we can talk about any ways this can be sped up. Even though you do mention that there aren't any federal issues for delaying till the end of the year, I still think there's, again, interest in moving this along. So, members, with that, we will meet a week from today. And thank you very much, both of you, for coming and for your informative presentation. On next week's agenda, we will have a bill from Representative Junkie. And then we also have another in our series of hearings and conversations with MnDOT. We're going to talk about the DDE program next week. There's a lot of questions and issues with the Disadvantaged Business Enterprise program and related issues, and we have at least two or three members on this committee that have come to me with real interest in this, so we're going to hear from MnDOT on that next week. So, with that, members, thank you very much for your participation. We stand adjourned.